Hello, welcome to The Wheel of Time After Time, the TV review show for fans who never read the books. I'm fantasy author Sean Paul Stevens, and joining us from Bournemouth in the UK is fantasy junkie Mark.
Hello!
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
And we also have fantasy author Patrick Samphire here, coming from Abergavenny in Walesland. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, evening all. How are we doing?
Very well. And we've got also in podcaster Mike Queller, our American Bible of everything, Wheel of Time, and he's popping in from Atlanta in Georgia. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So, season finale, loads to talk about. Let's start with a quick roundup of the story. Lanfear throws Moraine and Lan out of the ways outside of Falm before transporting herself and Rand into the city, where Rand confronts and kills Turak and his men. Lanfear alerts Ishmael to Rand's presence, making him realize she has betrayed him. Ishmael has Padan Fain deliver Mat the dagger from Shadar Lagoth to kill Rand with, but Mat refuses to take it and escapes. The White Cloaks, led by Dane and his father Geofram, attack Falm to eradicate the Seanchan. During the chaos, Ingtar, Loial, and Masema escape with the Horn of Valer and join the battle alongside Mat, Perrin, and the Aiel. Gwen manages to break free from her Adam and kill Renna. Mat is forced to blow the horn, summoning the heroes of the horn and turning the tide of the battle. Rand, Egwene, Nynaeve, Perrin, and Mat reunite and are confronted by Ishmael, who has Rand shielded from the One Power and tricks Mat into wounding Rand. While Egwene and Perrin fight Ishmael, Moraine frees Rand from the shield, allowing him to slay Ishmael. Rand is proclaimed the Dragon Reborn before the whole city. After the battle, Lanfear is confronted by Mogedion, another of the Forsaken, and learns all Forsaken have been set free. So let's jump in with a reaction to episode 8. Let's start with Mike.
For the most part, I liked it. They hit all of the plot points from the book within reason. I have a couple problems with it. One point really, really made me angry, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. But overall, I liked it. I'd give it an 8 out of 10.
Very nice. Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess, what we were expecting from the climax of the season. Everyone who had been separate for most of the season came together for one reason or another into Falm, and there was a massive fight, and the purported good guys won. And then there's some twists waiting for us with a lot more bad guys for future seasons.
Mark, what did you think?
As an episode of fantasy television, it was good and entertaining, and I enjoyed it. As an episode that I'm watching to then talk about on a podcast the next day, there were lots of things that annoyed me. That said, it was fun. I did enjoy it. It probably agree with Mike and give it about an 8. And I think it pretty much did exactly what I thought it was going to do, which was a kind of a chaotic episode with lots of people doing their own things to get to the hole with Rand being proclaimed at the end. But yeah, lots of detail that didn't bear up to scrutiny, I don't think.
Yeah, there was a lot to get through, wasn't there? I was kind of fearful beforehand that with so much to tie up, it was going to be a bit jumpy. I don't know, I think they did okay with that. I quite liked the episode. I thought it was a good spectacle, but I wasn't necessarily immersed in it because I did find some of the logic of things happening a little bit difficult to follow. I found it a bit confusing why suddenly all these people are fighting these other people. But the magic scenes were great, the production was great, and it did feel like a season finale. So I think all in all, they did pretty good. Okay, let's start with Egwene and what's going on with her rescue situation, which didn't really need to happen because she managed to rescue herself pretty much. Patrick, what did you think of the whole Egwene and the demand thing, how she manages to collar her captor?
There was a degree, and we talked before recording the episode, and there's definitely questions on how this whole thing with the demand and the handler work. From what Mike's told us about the books, the TV show has decided to handle the demand handler thing entirely differently. Yeah, my understanding in the books that the demand is nothing more than a giant battery, whereas in the show, they clearly have a lot more control over their power and what they do with it and how it's used. And the handler is more someone who controls them rather than the power. So it seems like that's a big change. And take it for what it is. The show is the show, the books are the book, and they're not necessarily the same thing at all. So the logic of how it worked, did it work? I think we could stretch it to make it work, that they were both collared by each other, both experiencing the other's pain, and Egwene was more able to hold on to the pain.
We have to take it on faith.
We have to accept it.
Yeah, that everything makes sense. We probably didn't have time to explain it. I guess if it was a book, you'd have, you know, several paragraphs explaining exactly what's going on. What about her dummy? What happened with that? Because she spat her dummy out.
And then got angry. So, yeah, perfect.
They could spit them out. Why didn't they just do that before?
Well, the dummy is just symbolic, isn't it? It doesn't do anything. It's kind of symbolic that they're not, they don't have a voice. They don't have any control. They are the slave in this.
What did you think of this section, Mark?
Yeah, I think Patrick's probably has nailed the collaring scene quite well. I think we do have to take it as we see it and roll with it. I mean, there are little hints beforehand, you know, her saying that the Soldam, whose name I can't remember, is a channeler, but she's not very strong at all, hence why Egwene can and do what she does. I found Egwene's reticence to barbecue a few white cloaks odd, considering she'd been captured and tortured by them in season one. She didn't want to do it.
She stopped when she did it at first, but she stopped when she saw that there were civilians and children being hit by these blasts.
I don't understand. Sean Chan don't like channelers, right? So they have to capture them or whatever and then use them. Now we're saying that Renner is a channeler. It doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Yeah, too weak to channel on her own, but enough, I guess, to be able to control her and her minion.
And Mike, what about the whole thing? Renner points out that if she dies, Egwene will die. What happened there? Did I miss something? Because obviously she didn't die.
Well, Renner freed Egwene. So Egwene was no longer a Demone. So then when Renner died, nothing transferred over to Egwene.
Did Renner die? I wasn't sure that she had died.
I thought she died. I thought it was one of these character arc moments, isn't it? You know, when she realizes she can kill or whatever, and from now on she'll probably become the next, I don't know, Silence of the Lambs or something.
I thought, well, I'm going to have to rewatch that because I didn't think she had died, and I thought Egwene had, despite having said I'm going to kill you earlier, had decided not to. But maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to rewatch that part.
No, Renner very clearly died. But going back to the Soldam can channel, so that doesn't make sense. Like, there are three types of people in the world. There are the people who will channel whether they want to or not. There are the people who can learn how to channel but don't necessarily need to. And then there are people who can't channel at all. And Demone are the people who will channel whether they want to or not. It'll just become their life. Like, they just will start channeling. The Soldam are the people who can learn how to channel. And the Sean Chan don't realize that. And when that comes out and that knowledge becomes known in the Sean Chan Empire, it's going to cause some serious problems. That may or may not be something that is explained in the Great Hunt. And then the Sean Chan get driven off and retreat back to their continent and then just never come back.
I don't get the feeling this is a series where anyone's storyline just ends. I think they just keep growing and growing until there's more and more and more storylines and you can never finish.
What on earth would make you think that? Is it the fact that three books near the end are referred to as the slog?
Okay, let's talk about Lan and Moraine having their little stroll on the beach. My main issue with this is how come the red cloak people were chasing them from the wrong end of the beach? Someone help me.
That's the way down the cliff.
that's lazy.
I mean, that would seem like the obvious thing. It looked like a nice beach. I was thinking that'd be a nice place to take a holiday there.
Yeah, it wasn't Brighton, was it?
I too get that joke, knowing all about England's beaches.
Yeah, Brighton is just stony beached.
Their water looked a lot cleaner, I have to say.
How comes when Lanfear chucks them through the waygate, Moraine doesn't just reopen the waygate? Because at that point, they don't know where they are. They could be anywhere on Earth. Well, I don't know if we're on Earth. maybe not. What was going on there? Am I missing something? Can she not open gates now? I thought she had her power back.
She does, and she could have.
And would she have been able to navigate through the whatever that place is called in between the way gates?
It was Loyal who led them through the first time, right?
I'm going to assume not, considering she asked Lanfear if it was the right exit.
Yeah.
In the books, Mike, is there no kind of map of the ways, or is it just the Ogiers that know how to go there?
In the books, when you go into the ways, you walk along a path and then you come to like this intersection point, and there's a sign there that says this way goes off this. So if you want to go here, go this way. If you want to go here, go this way. If you want to go here, go this way.
I could really do with an A to Z, stroke Z for you, Mike, map just to, so they know where everywhere is. You know, I can imagine it being a bit like the knowledge, like if you were a London cabbie.
Yeah, I also wondered, I mean, where they came out on the beach, how close was that to the city, and like how many way gates are there around there?
She took them there, so maybe they went to sleep and reappeared. I don't know how she gets about. It's not really made clear, is it? Mark, what did you think about Lan's sword play on the beach? He was very good, wasn't he?
Yeah. It was a sword fight on a beach with a bunch of average soldiers fighting him. I mean, he can catch arrows. That's cool. You know, we always like that. That's, I think, like when you're concentrating on a couple of blokes in front of you with swords, having the situational awareness to pluck arrows out of the air is great. But I don't think this would be the most meaningful chat we have about arrows today. We'll get to that one. and again, I mean, I don't think they were shooting arrows at Moraine, which would have been the obvious target. It was a scrap on a beach. It was, you know, yeah. I think that whole point was to, I mean, they, again, I think they alluded that Lanfear set that up to put them in the right place at the right time to do the right thing to further her goals, which we're still not 100% sure what they are, but it meant that Moraine could, of course, destroy the boats and fulfill the prophecy.
Mike, is there any kind of like limitations on using the one power for like distance or anything?
My understanding, or the way I remember it from the books, is that you have to be able to see the person you are channeling at, or at least if you want to shield somebody, like if you want to shield somebody the way they were shielding Rand, you have to be able to see him.
Okay, so how did the Sean Chan see Rand from there?
Because the writers needed it to happen.
Move along.
That's
now.
Why they went out on the boat, I guess, and with a good view of the tower.
And that's why they stood.
Rand was standing by the edge.
Yeah.
It's possible they might have been able to see him.
They could have also had Ishmael providing targeting information. You know, he was up there.
A spotter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's have a little think about Nynaeve and Elaine. Now, I was really hoping from the setup of the previous episode that it was going to be this great Ocean's 11-style heist rescue attempt for Egwene. Although, obviously, we've already discovered that she didn't actually need rescuing. So I felt a bit cheated there as a viewer, because I felt I'd been set up to expect that. And in the end, they just basically hung out on the street and talked about first aid. Mark, how did you find the little scene with the arrow?
for the people listening who can't see it, Mark has collapsed into his chair and he may be dead.
It was painful to watch anything with it continues to be painful to watch anything with Nynaeve. You know, she's apart from Rand, the Dragon Reborn, she's the one person in this show who we felt had the potential to be something amazing, and yet we're still waiting for that to happen, and she just continues to stumble from scene to scene being pretty shit. And by this episode, she's even forgotten her wisdom training. You're going to push the arrow through the wound. Okay, we've seen that done in plenty of shows. But for the love of God, break the flight off the end of it first.
Are we meta-information? Because they've probably never seen a fantasy show. And we've read a lot of fantasy books and seen a lot of fantasy shows. And we know you have to break the end off. But maybe it has
Nynaeve
about...
Nynaeve is from the Two Rivers, which is kind of a backwater farming community where their main weapons are bows and arrows, and they are known for their longbows and their archery skills. I feel like there would have been a lot of arrow wounds, whether, you know, accidental or maybe not. So
that notwithstanding, it looks fairly bloody obvious, doesn't it? If I'm going to, it's got the arrow point on one end, and it's got something on the other end, and I guess it doesn't matter which end you break off.
Well, this is one of the scenes where I wondered whether we were skipping little bits for time, because we also didn't see her bandage the wound afterwards. We saw, oh, well, I'm going to push this through. Ow, ow, ow. Can you walk? And the answer is, no, I can't walk. I've just had an arrow pushed through my fucking leg. At least bandage it first.
Exactly. That's happened to me. I'm not walking nowhere for at least a month.
I wondered if we were just skipping over these things for time.
A good question comes with this. I assume Aes Sedai can't heal themselves?
They cannot, no.
Okay.
I think that came up in season one, maybe. Something about not being able to heal themselves.
Anyway, but somehow they turn up at the end on top of the tower.
And do nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Nynaeve did nothing.
Again.
What did Elaine do?
No, Elaine at least did something, didn't she? She healed Rand, and then they gave each other a look, which is, you know,
as
I was saying, this is why I think we're going to Love Triangle next season, and it's going to be a fight between Egwene and Elaine for Rand's affections and Lamphere, in fact. So it's a love quadrangle, isn't it? God knows why. He's very boring.
We can't ignore it anymore. Let us talk about Matt getting the horn now.
All right. Okay. Let's do this.
This was a quite exciting part of the show, but also one with a few little elements of debate amongst us, I think. Mark, where do you want to start with Matt's horn?
So I'm going to... We'll skip past the fact that we didn't see them actually getting the horn. We'll ignore that. But yes, plot gap. But yeah, the horn looks stupid. They've entrusted it to...
Yeah, what the fuck kind of Fisher-Price Toys R Us plastic kitty horn? Like, bleh.
This is the angriest Mike's been
the actual
season.
Horn gonna get worse. Here is like a really fancy-ass French horn. That's what it is. And they're like, oh, here's this. It looks like a Fisher-Price toy.
It is really strange because the production design has been really good this season until they pulled out that cheap plastic gold-sprayed piece of crap from the box. I mean, why didn't he look at it and go, is this it? You know, what the fuck is this?
I think you've got a question as well. Why they would entrust the Horn of Valyr to Matt?
Yeah, the only reason I could think of was because he was the one that managed to open the box with his lightsaber.
I have issues around that whole spear. I don't think you can just loosely tie a knife to the end of a stick and make an effective spear.
No.
I think you'd have to tie it really hard and really get it in, not just kind of vaguely.
So what he created there is a staff with a blade on the end, which from about halfway through book four through the end of the series is Matt's signature weapon. Like, that is his weapon that he carries around the entire series.
Well, I feel like you'd need to kind of clamp it in between and really tighten it, not just kind of lay them together and kind of gently wrap a bit of cloth around it and hope that's going to hold up to going in a battle.
I'm not explaining it. I'm just explaining why they did it.
So the whole point.
No, it's all your fault, Mike.
Well, I did the best I could. Okay, people are going to be angry no matter what. So I did what made me happy.
So Matt, being Matt, proving that he can't be trusted, decided, "Oh, I'm in a bit of a pickle now. Best blow this bloody thing to save my own ass," because he would have no other motivation than what we saw. You know, he's on that bridge-type battlement. He's the one in trouble. He decides to blow the horn to save his own backside.
There's a rationale given in the books. He basically says, you know, the horn has to be there and has to be blown at the last battle, but nothing says the horn can't be blown before that, so I'm going to blow it now. And also in the books, it's to save kind of everybody else. It's not just him. It's like him and like everyone else. Like Perrin and Loial and Ingtar and all of them are surrounded.
There must be a limit to how often you can blow it, though. Like, you know, I mean, surely they're going to get pissed off, aren't they, if he's blowing it just for a pub fight.
Heroes who become less and less willing to actually do something each time you blow it, and eventually they're like, fuck off.
That sounds like something Pratchett would write, doesn't it? Oh dear. So, and then we get the heroes appear.
Yeah, yes. The heroes, they look great. Mike, what did you think of the heroes? As you expected them?
Okay, all right. Okay. Hold on. Stop. Because we're very low on time, and so I got to get my anger out. Number one, first of all, Ingtar is a dark friend, and it was never brought up in the show, and his whole reason for hunting the horn was that he wanted to get the horn, blow the horn, and redeem himself, because he didn't want to be a dark friend anymore. But he just dies, and it's never mentioned. Ingtar was a dark friend. There it is.
Okay. So you've just mentioned Ingtar just dying. He said that. He died about 10 seconds after saying, and one man could hold 50 in this alley or something.
Yeah, and then immediately
dies to about 5.
Well, he was wrong, basically.
Hold on, I got to get back to the heroes of the horn. We can't talk. We can't. They're plot holes. Yes, we know. So they blow the horn and like 10 guys show up, right? And it's like, first of all, there's like 100 heroes of the horn. And so 10 guys show up. One of them is fucking Uno, who's not a hero of the horn, right? And then Matt all of a sudden goes, oh, I remember everything. I'm a hero of the horn. And I'm like, no, you're fucking Matt. It is explicitly stated in the books. Matt asks one of the heroes of the horn, hey, am I one of you? And that guy responds, no, you should be for everything that you've done, but you've not been chosen to be one. I don't know why. So you're not a hero of the horn. And Matt's like, great, I don't want to be one anyway. And Matt is not a hero of the horn.
In the books, he's not a hero of the horn. In the show, which is an entirely different story, he is a hero of the horn.
Yeah, which is, yeah. And I'm.
How could we all be sat here saying hero of the horn with a straight face?
I have rolled with all of the changes so far. I have not had a problem really with any of the changes so far, but that one, oh my God, made me so angry. I'm still angry now. Like, I am legitimately angry about that change.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I quickly mention two things that annoyed me? Thing number one was I'm going to call it blatantly ripping off Indiana Jones when we see Rand facing off with all those soldiers and the Lord Fella, and they all get their swords out, and then he blasts them all with magic. Awesome. Yeah. Kills them all.
Took a gun to a knife fight.
Exactly that. So we've got a bit of Untouchables in there as well. When did he get that good with magic? That annoyed me. That we jumped from him barely able
a reason that he could do stuff like that, which I'm not going to disclose right now.
Okay. And then the other thing that annoyed me, and if anybody who knows me knows this would annoy me, didn't need to kill Hopper.
Yeah.
Didn't do anything for the story. It's not like at that moment, Perrin was so angered, it didn't progress his story, didn't become more powerful, didn't discover a latent ability. He got angry and he killed the guy who killed Hopper. But he probably would have done that anyway because the guy was distracted. He would have seen him as a white cloak. They're fighting the white cloaks. Kill him. It was pointless. We don't like the mindless killing of animals. Thank you very much. Move on.
All right, let's talk about the final battle. It's got to be done. They're all up there on the tower. Ishmael does his little illusion trick to supposedly get Rand stabbed by the dagger, which should, in theory, kill him in a few seconds, I believe. He's pretty much okay. I didn't get really why they were all standing on top of a tower anyway, apart from the convenience, and it probably looked good.
But they were all going to get Egwene, weren't they? And she was up there, and everyone was trying to rescue her as the whole point, and that's where she was, because that's where all of the Shan Chan were. And it made it much more dramatic. If it had just been in a room somewhere, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as dramatic.
Let's be fair, with the very, very final scene, nobody would have seen the fiery dragon if they're in a room.
It'd been rubbish.
They would have been really pants. I think something about that scene, I think we moan about Nynaeve, or I moan about Nynaeve not being powerful. And I think part of it doesn't help that we've seen Egwene getting so powerful. When she's doing something awesome, it just makes Nynaeve look even worse again.
Well, Nynaeve has a block. You know, it's been talked about throughout the season that Nynaeve can't channel unless she's really angry or really afraid.
Clearly, she would be both of those in that situation.
Yeah, she's hard to, and I remember at the beginning of the season why readers seem to hate Nynaeve in the books. And honestly, I'm getting a bit fed up with her in the show, even though she might not be the same as the books. And it really doesn't help that she's completely failed to get over her block. But on the other hand, it's one book and it's a very long series, so I'd assume she'll eventually get over it.
And what about Ishmael, Patrick? Do you think he's gone for good?
Maybe. I hope so. I mean, as I've said before, I'm on his side. I've been on his side all the way through. I think he's the hero of this season. And hopefully he's finally got what he wanted, which is not to be reborn again.
He could get like a spin-off series like Frasier from Cheers, you know?
They could call it Ishy Lives, and it would be really disappointing, wouldn't it? Yeah, I certainly alluded to it. His dying words were, and then that whole scene alluded to the fact that he's gone for good. But, in the context of the wheel, we don't know.
Mike, what are you hoping for next season? Obviously, hopefully that it will be quicker to film than season two.
Pretty much what they did this season, where they followed the general outline of the books, like hitting all of the important plot points, but getting to them in different ways was fun. Was a interesting way to see it. And if they follow the plot from the third book, we should have some interesting stuff happen. Although a lot of the stuff from the third book came up in this season, so we may be getting like book condensation coming together.
I think we are, because the producers said there were going to be 10 seasons of this, and clearly they've got to fit 14 books into 10 seasons. So at some point...
Well, I mean, 8, 9, and 10 could be half a season.
Okay, well, let's hope that Nynaeve gets some powers and starts kicking some ass. That's all we've got time for this episode and for this season of Wheel of Time After Time. Thank you to all of the panel. Patrick, you can check out his books, Patrick Samphire. Mike, you have books and podcasts. I have books. Mark, you're...
I will just go back into obscurity for another couple of years.
Well, we'll look forward to meeting up again and meeting up with all you guys listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.